And in a moment, Captain Kevin Randall joins us as we talk about abductions and past lives. He has worked in this area for more than 45 years, and he is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Kevin Randall, back with us. Kevin has more than 45 years experience studying the UFO phenomenon in all areas. His training by the Army, the Air Force provides him with that keen insight into operations and protocols of the military, how they investigate. He has interviewed, let me tell you folks, hundreds of witnesses who were involved in everything from the Roswell, New Mexico crash of 1947 to repeated radar sightings of UFOs, the Washington, D.C. flap in 52, incredible abduction cases as well. And we're going to talk about some right now. Kevin, welcome back, Captain.
Well, thank you very much, and I hate to correct you on your own show, but I retired as a lieutenant colonel.
You did? You got those stripes?
We went up the ladder.
Good for you. Well, we all need to change your bio there, Lieutenant Colonel.
Yes, I think we do.
Well, good for you. And by the way, thank you for serving, Kevin, because, you know, you put in a lot of time in different areas. So thank you for everything you've done there.
On the other side of the coin, I did get some free trips to exotic parts of the world.
Yes, you did. Like, did you go to Iraq?
Yes.
That's what I thought.
And I spent a year in Vietnam as a helicopter pilot, so.
What a mess it is right now, Kevin. I mean, you saw firsthand. It's out of control now, isn't it?
Well, I think the problem was that there was no plan once Saddam Hussein was deposed. There was no plan for what to do. They didn't really plan for that sort of thing, and that is where everything broke down. And then they kind of got things organized and got things stabilized, and then we pulled all our troops out, and now it's become a bigger mess.
Yeah, it sure is. Kevin, let's talk about some of your most recent work now as you begin to look into abduction cases. Years ago, you had a book out called Conversations. Tell me a little bit about what you've been doing lately and how this ties into some of those things.
Well, Conversations began with a woman who had contacted me and thought she had been abducted. And I am always... Later on, I became very reluctant to deal with abduction cases simply because you're beginning to deal with people's emotions and a lot of things that are going on in their heads, and I just didn't want to deal with that sort of thing. I had started, in fact, I'm the first one to report aliens coming into the house in a case that I had reported on in 1976, and I think it's the first time it was ever reported aliens inside the house, and then later on things changed in the way abductions took place. But I had become very uncomfortable with doing abduction research simply because of the trauma that many of the witnesses, the abductees, exhibited, and just realized that you cannot do research and therapy at the same time. They will come in conflict with one another at some point. And so I became very uncomfortable with this, but this woman wanted some help, and I enlisted the aid of a friend of mine who was versed in hypnosis to look into it and see if we could maybe at least put her on the right track to stopping the nightmares that she was having. And that was how I got involved in Conversations, and Conversations is sort of the story of how that all came about and all the various places that it went. It didn't go into abduction. It went in a different direction, and that surprised me a great deal.
During that time period, what was happening in terms of UFO sightings and other abductions? Was it widespread?
No, it was the thing took place after the 50th anniversary of the Roswell case, and if you track the evolution of sighting reports, it sort of peaked in July of 1997 with that Roswell festival. Everything sort of built up to then. There was a lot of interest, but once we hit the festival, it was almost like somebody shut a switch off, and the number of sighting reports dropped off, and the interest in UFOs dropped off. So this was a time when we were on the down cycle of interest in UFOs. So that was kind of what was going on. And then we move on to the Stevensville sightings and the Chicago O'Hare sightings. But that's like 10 years in the future for us in this investigation. So it was a period that was where not much was going on in the way of UFOs, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Now tell us about Jenny in this case.
Well, she was a woman who was obviously having the nightmares, and we used I've used a pseudonym for her because of where this thing went. It got really weird. So we go into this thinking we're going to get an abduction, and we start the hypnotic regression after it's set up, everything is set up, and we're talking to her, and we're starting the hypnotic regression, and it suddenly becomes clear that she's not talking about an abduction. She's talking about something else. And I had done a book on near-death experiences 4 or 5 years earlier, so I was familiar with the research that had been going on, and it suddenly struck me that she's not talking about an abduction scenario. She's talking about a near-death experience. And as we're talking to her about, she's going into the light and she's got the beings around her and she can't really make out who they are. And it's reminding me of this. And we had agreed, Tom and I, and Tom is a pseudonym for the guy I worked with as well, but we had agreed that he would ask the question so there wouldn't be a lot of distraction for her. And at that point, she's talking about what happened and what's going on. And finally he says, well, what's happening? And she says, well, I died.
Hmm.
And this just flabbergasts us. You died. And I realized from the near-death experiences that I'd talked about or I'd been studying that many times people come back from that experience and have these incredible stories they tell. And so then we began looking into it in more depth, and she began to tell in subsequent sessions, she began to tell about these horrific crimes she was involved in back in the 18th and 19th centuries. And we're listening to this, trying to figure out what's going on. Here is this gentle woman, this woman who is so kind, it's unbelievable, basically somewhat shy, and now she's talking about committing these horrific crimes in the 19th century, and it became clear that she's relating to us that she is actually working with Jack the Ripper. She's not the Ripper himself. She's working with a guy who is doing... it's sort of a symbiotic relationship of these two guys doing the Ripper crime.
Like an associate.
Yes, and I'm going, I can't believe this. This is just incredible. It's just unbelievable. We're trying not to lead her. I understand the pitfalls of hypnotic regression. I understand the problems with using hypnosis in these sorts of things, but oftentimes that's the only tools that you have.
That's right.
And you have to be extremely careful in this. And we're trying not to ask suggestive questions. We're trying not to lead her in any direction. Trying not to give her any cue about what we're feeling about what she's saying. And she's talking about this these horrific crimes. And as I go into the research of the Ripper crimes, I realize she's describing events that, fit into with the Ripper crimes. Now, in today's age, you go on the internet, you can find out practically anything. The entire human body of knowledge is available on the internet.
Right, and you just have to memorize it.
But this is 15 years ago, before the internet was quite as useful as it is now. But the information was out there to be found. So you're not dealing with something that's so obscure that she couldn't possibly have known it. Because I'm doing the research. I'm using the library at the University of Iowa. I'm using other resources available. I'm using the internet as well. So it's not something that is unavailable. So the information is out there. So she could be setting something like this up and studying this and giving it back to us. in this incredible storm. But what is the motivation for it?
Right. I mean, and how do they do that, Kevin, if they're under hypnosis? How, I mean, if they're trying to falsify something, how do they pull that off?
Well, under hypnosis, you can draw on anything that you know. You can draw on all the knowledge. When I was doing my first research into abductions, and I was working with Jim Harder from the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization. He was their director of research, and we'd gone out to investigate a case in Utah. I had asked him to come out to use the hypnotic regression in that case. And I remember him telling me that you cannot lie under hypnosis. And so we've got the subject, this Pat Roach, under hypnosis, and she's telling us these stories. And he says, well, you can't lie under hypnosis. I found out later on you can lie under hypnosis. You can make up stuff. You can get involved with what's known as trying to please the operator. In other words, you're trying to please the hypnotist. You're very suggestible. So it's possible for this stuff to come forward. But as a pre-planned hoax to say, well, I want to look into these nightmares I'm having, and it seems to be it's alien abduction. That's what her friends were telling her, and that sort of thing. And we get into the research, and it takes this bizarre turn into reincarnation and past lives, and we end up with the idea that this was an associate of Jack the Ripper. But it even goes beyond that, where it's like this: she was this malevolent source. Being in the past, this entity that just thrived on these horrific crimes, and as we moved around, we found other things that she may have been involved in, and so it's you know what now she's evolved into something or someone who was much kinder and much gentler than in these past lives that she's claiming to have lived.
That's remarkable, Kevin. I remember, must have been about 1971. I interviewed Dr. Benjamin Simon. You know that name. He was the psychiatrist involved in the Betty and Barney Hill case. I asked him specifically what you just said, and I said, are they telling the truth? Because he had them both under hypnosis separately. And he said, I don't know what happened to them, George. I really don't, except whatever happened to them, they believe it to be the truth. And so he said they were not lying. They actually believed that they were abducted.
And I think Jerry Clark has written an article about experience anomalies, and this is kind of what we're talking about right now. I was just at a small conference in Minnesota, and Jerry gave a paper there. I talked about this experience anomalies, and what it is, it's sort of like a hallucination, but it's not. It's people telling these strange tales of these anomalous events, and you know, it's they believe it. They believe they really experienced it. It goes beyond hallucination. It goes beyond those sorts of things. So it's sort of a different theoretical construct, I guess, that we don't really understand at this point. But it moves us, you know, sort of between our shared reality and some of the paranormal activities that people talk about and people believe take place. And this is where this whole thing with Jenny fits into it. It's this experience anomaly.
What did you conclude personally? That she was telling the truth? That she was indeed an associate of Jack the Ripper?
I concluded that she was relating what she clearly believed to be the truth.
Right.
Which is not to say that she was actually an associate of Jack the Ripper, but she clearly believed it. And the information she provided seemed to suggest that's exactly what she was. Her voice changed. She began speaking with a somewhat English accent. It was a much deeper, raspier voice than she normally spoke in. And she had some of the mannerisms and the linguistical anomalies that you hear from the English people when they speak the colloquialisms. As they speak, she seemed to know some of the details of what was going on and provided a logical explanation for why the Ripper murder stopped when they stopped. But she also suggested that and I know that the people who are into Jack the Ripper, you know, talk about the main crimes, but there's always this suspicion that the Ripper actually killed more people.
That's right.
That he started earlier and they ended later than the traditional cases. And she suggested that. She suggested why you get police descriptions of two different men involved in the Ripper murders. It's because there were two different men involved in it, and things like that. And so it's, you know, she provided information that, and I freely admit, is available. When we were doing this research, it wasn't as available as it is today, but it was clearly information that she could have accessed in some fashion.
Did she ever mention who he might be? There have been rumors that he was part of the royal family. There was another story of two Scotland Yard police officers wrote a book that said that he was a heart doctor who ended up moving to St. Louis, Missouri, a long time ago.
She gave enough clues that I could figure out who she was talking about. It was a guy who committed suicide or died in 1891, according to what she said. But what was interesting is, as we skipped around looking for other past lives, she also came up with a personality of a guy she called Frank, or we called Frank, based on what she'd said, that was involved in the Black Dahlia killings. And I recognized some of that because if you look at the 1947 newspapers, July of 1947 newspapers, you see that there was a crime committed around July 2nd, July 3rd, and it says it was part of the cycle they believe started with the Black Dahlia. So I go back to January of 1947 when the Black Dahlia was killed, and now Jenny is feeding us some of that information as well. So we're getting this malevolent entity that seemed to live through the ages, returning periodically to commit these horrendous crimes. So you get a nice, what the book really does is give you a nice history of the Jack the Ripper crimes, the Black Dahlia crimes, some other stuff like that, but it also interlaces the hypnotic regression sessions we had with her and the information that came out of that and the information that I was doing trying to verify what she was saying and seeing how it fit into all these other crimes.
Without her abduction case, would you ever have stumbled across her?
Absolutely not. No, there would be no reason for me to get involved at all. It was simply because she was aware of some of the abduction research I had done in the past, and had we not been looking for the alien abduction, and we ended up with this near-death experience, when she talked about going into the light, and we started to explore that, is where we ended up with this other information. So the book begins with the abduction research in it, and it kind of, you know, follows the investigation as it played out for us.
How often does this happen, Kevin, with abduction cases where people talk about the abduction and then they go into these other very strange areas?
I don't know how often that happens. I do know that in the abduction research those who experience abduction often talk about how they have an increase in their psychic abilities, whatever those abilities might have been. And so this might be some of that. She might have tapped into something as well that was giving her these horrific nightmares. And the problem was the nightmares. And we were just trying to see what we could do to eliminate the nightmares, and we were successful in doing that.
All right, hold on, Kevin. We're going to hit the break, but we're going to come right back and talk a little bit more about this and some conspiracies of UFOs. And our special guest tonight, Lieutenant Colonel retired Kevin Randall, as we talk about alien abductions and past lives as well. He's talking about his incredible case of a woman named Jenny. We'll get more into that and some other abduction cases when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you with Kevin Randall. Kevin's website, by the way, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com for you right now. We're talking about the case of Jenny that Kevin was investigating under an alien abduction case. And under hypnotherapy, she started talking about a past life where she was probably an associate of Jack the Ripper. Now, but in that time period, Kevin, she was a he, was she not?
Yes. Yes. In fact, in a number of the past lives we managed to talk to her about, she was male, but there were others when she was female. So we looked at a whole range of stuff with her under the hypnotic regression.
What did you conclude about her?
Once again, I'm very schizophrenic on this thing, because the scientific portion of me says, well, this past life regression stuff just doesn't really work.
Right. You seem like you're wrestling with your views on her. Are you?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Because then you go back and you look at the story, and yes, everything that we were able to corroborate from what she said, she was telling the accurate information. One of the cases that started sort of a past life, interest in this country was the case, the search for Bridie Murphy. And I touch on that in the book. And what struck me about that, and I've actually put part of that chapter up on my blog, was because the way the establishment reacted to this tale of Bridie Murphy, who under hypnotic regression claimed to have been, the name they use in the book is Ruth Simmons, and she claimed that she had been a woman named Bridie Murphy in the middle of the 19th century, living in Ireland, and provided a lot of information that was corroborated by the research the guys were doing about this. But the establishment really went after Bridie Murphy and labeled this whole thing a hoax. And when you look at you can disregard the idea of reincarnation, but you cannot disregard it for the reasons that the establishment said about Bridie Murphy, because they made stuff up. Frankly, the mainstream media made stuff up to discredit the Bridie Murphy case. And one of the major articles was written by a Catholic priest. Well, the church had edited out all references to reincarnation out of the Bible. So they were quite disturbed by this revelation of Bridie Murphy. So you get this idea that it was a hoax, and everybody said, oh, yeah, Bridie Murphy, that was proved to be a hoax. Well, it really wasn't proven to be a hoax. And what I look at is the same things going on in the UFO field. You know, today we say, well, there was a UFO crash at Roswell, and what we really get is a lot of people saying, well, there really was, and right. It was a weather balloon and all this crap, and the Air Force proved it. But you go back and you look at that, and you can say that Roswell wasn't a alien craft, but you cannot reject it for the reasons the Air Force said, because the reasons don't really work. And that's, you know, kind of where I am on all of this schizophrenic mindset of mine on this reincarnation. Mm-hmm. The stories told by Jenny and the information that I could checked out. It was there. It was accurate information. And yeah, there's disagreements with what others have written about Jack the Ripper and these other crimes, but that would be a matter of perspective. It wasn't something that you could say, well, this eliminates this story completely from it. It's that sort of thing. So I struggle with this sort of thing, because as I say, the skeptical mind says, yeah, well, you can't do this. And yet here is this incredible story. So this is this kind of this experience anomaly that Jerry Clark had talked about.
Are you still in touch with Jenny, Kevin?
No. You're no. I haven't talked to her in probably around 15 years. And what we did when we finished everything up, we gave the tapes and the transcripts and everything to her. Actually, we gave them to her husband. We explain in the book that as we were doing the research, the reason we had started was because, you know, she came to us with these dreams. And as we were doing the research, the nightmare stopped, and she could sleep through the night, and she wasn't disturbed. And we get to the end of this, and we said, well, when we're done, you know, we'll give you everything that we have. You know, there was always a post-hypnotic suggestion that she wouldn't remember what right. She had told us during the session, but she would wake refreshed and feeling better. And that worked out fine. So we reached a point where the mission is accomplished. Her nightmares have ended. And so now we're struggling with the ethical dilemma. What do we do with the tapes? What do we do with the transcripts? What do we do with all this information? Because we said we'd give it to her, and we decided we'd give it to her husband and explain to him and explain to her exactly, you know, this is something you probably don't want to go into, but if you want to, hear the stuff is because it's yours. And so she has that stuff. And from what I can determine, she has never said anything publicly about any of this. So the book, you know, that's one of the problems with the book. You know, we cannot reveal who Jenny really was because that's violating the agreement that we worked under. But it was a story that was so fascinating that I thought it should be told. And so the book reads sort of like a mystery, but it brings in all this other evidence. There's discussion of Edgar Cayce because he dealt with reincarnation and past lives and how that came about. So it brings in the evidence. It kind of creates this schizophrenic portion of my mind of, yeah, this is true. Well, I don't know if it's true. It just doesn't seem to be scientifically based, and we don't have the evidence, the precise evidence to prove it to anybody other than to say, this is a very interesting story. Here is what we can tell you about it. You can check the details of some of this yourself easily today, not so easily when we were doing the investigation, but you still could have found it had you been out there looking for it. I cannot see Jenny actually going out and doing this and creating this sort of thing, so I don't know how it came about.
Did you believe the alien abduction story?
We never really... My feeling on the abductions has always been that the numbers being claimed is way out of proportion, and that if you have an alien abduction, it's going to be more like the Bonnie and Betty Hill story or more like the Travis Walton case. Some of these other stories of abduction, I think, have a more terrestrial explanation. And so I've always been of that kind of opinion that many of them can be explained. A sleep paralysis, for example, does explain some abduction tales. Doesn't explain them all, but explains some of them. And so it's always been that sort of thing. So when she was talking about the abduction, my initial thought was, well, it's probably something else. Because, you know, the abduction aspect of it has always been kind of hard to get into. But we went in with the idea we're going to try to not lead her into anything. We're going to try to ask neutral questions, and you know, as we discussed in the book, at one point Tom said, well, did you plan this? And I thought, no, you don't want to say that, because now you're telling her that something was planned. You know, it's very hard to ask a neutral question without giving some kind of cue of what you're searching for, especially when someone is under hypnotic regression, where they're in a very suggestible state. You have to be very, very careful. So, it all kind of developed out of, well, it's an alien abduction. We'll see what we're doing. We can maybe help her understand. I had an experience in Edinburgh, Texas.
I'm going to be there next month, by the way, at a UFO conference.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Are you there?
No, I was there. I was there last year.
Okay.
And Noe Torre, and that it's just a wonderful experience.
Great
just
person.
Really, a great deal of fun.
Yeah.
But a guy came up to me with a UFO sighting, and I really don't need to hear another story of somebody seeing a UFO, because there's so many of them. But he was very disturbed by the sighting, so we talked a long time about this and what had transpired. It was an interesting sighting, it turns out, with multiple witnesses and all of this over Oklahoma City, And we talked about it, and I explained to him, nothing really happened. There's really nothing to be frightened about with these sightings. It's just, it's like seeing a lion in the distance or something like that. It's nothing to be really concerned about, really worried about. And we talked about it for about 30 minutes and discussed what had gone on and what he'd done and all of this. And after, then the conversation ended, and he went away, and he came back about 3 hours later and says, that really helped me. I'm just not really that concerned about the sighting anymore. The idea doesn't frighten me anymore. And I thought, well, I've done my job in that case. And that was kind of the thought process with Jenny, was maybe we can do something to help her out, or at least point her in a direction to get her some help to stop the nightmares. And we were successful in that mission, if you will.
Kevin, I want to talk about some of the other cases that you've been working on, past and present, and a few older UFO cases that are nationally known. It seems to me that we're not getting the kind of quality reports that we had 15, 20, 30 years ago. Is that an honest perception, or am I off?
Yeah, that comes up frequently in discussions of UFOs, especially in today's environment. And Carl Flock and I discussed this 20 years ago, that we just aren't getting the same kind of robust sightings. I read something just the other day that it may be the quality of the investigations, that we're not getting the people investigating them to the depth that had been investigated in the past. But I think it's really more, Carl and I thought, well, the aliens came, investigated Earth, gathered their data. Now they've gone home to analyze it. So we're not getting the same kind of sightings that we used to get. The October of 1973 wave, it was about a six-week period of very intense activity. A lot of UFOs seen on the ground, a lot of people seeing the occupants from inside the UFOs, number of abduction cases that took place. And what struck me about this is it was like, you take a bunch of graduate students into the field during a summer session to study whatever, and you gather your samples, you do your research, you go home to the university and you analyze. And that was kind of the thing that Carl and I thought. They've gathered their information, they've now gone home to analyze it before they come back and gather new information with new questions. So it seems to be true that we just are not getting the same kind of robust sightings that we used to get. And the other problem we have is, in today's environment, any 10-year-old kid with a computer can create a stunning
photograph. Video. Oh, absolutely. Or video. You're right. I mean, I remember the old-time pictures, Kevin. You know them too. That, the one where the individual took a picture outside of his truck window.
Mark,
I don't know.
Kaplan, yes.
I don't know if that was a hubcap or what. But those were great pictures that were not photoshopped. There might have been an object tossed in the way or something, but those weren't photoshopped.
Well, the other thing that Carl and I kind of discussed was that about 99% of the UFO pictures were taken by teenage boys, and 99% of those are faked. But you get into some. I talked to Carl Hart Jr. of the Lubbock Lights fame. He's the guy that took pictures of the Lubbock Lights. He was 19 years old when he took them. And a lot of the teenagers who faked these photographs have since come forward and said, yeah, I faked those. Well, I talked to Carl Hart in 1992, 93, 94, somewhere in that time frame. I happened to be in Lubbock on part of the investigation of the Roswell case. And on a lark, I looked Carl Hart up in the phone book, and his name was there, so I called him. And we had a nice chat, and what he said to me was, I still don't know what I photographed. The Air Force investigated. They threatened Carl Hart a number of times that if you're lying to us and we find out, there's going to be big trouble. The local newspaper, he'd been selling photographs to the newspaper, so he had a connection there, the local Avalanche Journal, I think it's called. And so he knew the photographic people and an editor there, and they said the same thing to him. We ever find out you fake these things, there's going to be hell to pay. But, when I talk to him, he's now in his 60s, so he's not worried about the Air Force or anybody else bothering him. But he said, I still don't know what I photographed. He doesn't think it was an alien spacecraft, but he said, I don't know what I photographed. So we've got those great old sightings and those great old photographs. Russ Estes did a fake UFO video, and he made the object in the video look really, really cheesy. So it was clear it would never be mistaken for something real, but he wanted to show how easy it is to maneuver the thing around the environment and make the comments about, oh my God, what am I seeing, and that sort of thing. So it looked like it was real, and how easy it is today in today's environment. So when you get pictures of UFOs today, my first thought is always, well, this is a hoax now, because it's so easy to do, and it's so damn difficult to show that it's faked.
Kevin, I'm particularly fascinated with the case of the late police officer Lonnie Zamora in Socorro, New Mexico. I mean, What an amazing story. He saw something. He wasn't making that up.
No, he wasn't. And what's interesting is, for a long time, people said, well, that's the only case in the UFO, the Project Blue Book files, where the guy saw the occupants and it's not labeled as psychological. There's actually three or four cases where they've seen occupants and they ended up in the unidentified category. But Zamora, this case is absolutely fascinating. There were landing traces left behind. You've got Hynek investigating the case within a couple of days. You've got an FBI guy on the scene within a matter of hours. You've got police, you've got military there looking at it. So it's an incredible case. And there was two guys who were traveling through New Mexico who lived in Dubuque, Iowa. And about a week after the Zamora case broke in the national press, there's a story in the Dubuque Herald Tribune, is that right? The Dubuque newspaper, the name of the newspaper escapes me, but the two guys were describing what they had seen as well and kind of corroborated parts of what Zamora said. But their story has been kind of ignored because it was suggested it was a hoax, that they had made the whole thing up because some of their descriptions didn't quite match with what Zamora said. But I'm thinking, you know, you're looking at it at a different angle. You're looking at it from a different perspective. You'd expect there to be some disagreements among those things. Phil Klass attempted to debunk it and said, well, this guy was living within 1,000 feet of the where it landed. He didn't hear a thing. He was outside in his garden working. And you discover the guy lives about a mile away, and he was inside the house. And he said, well, nothing was going on. I didn't see anything. And I'm thinking, you know, if you were living that close and you where you could see the thing, you would have seen the people in the field because there's photographs of them walking around this area and photographing the landing traces and all that. And you'd think the guy would have gone up to see what was going on. So, you know, it suggests to me that he didn't really have much to contribute to it. But Phil Klass was excited about that. And it's the same sort of thing I was talking about with the Bridey Murphy case where they made stuff up. Philip Klass said, well, the land where the UFO landed and Zamora saw it was owned by the mayor, and his idea was to create a tourist attraction, which would make him some money. But and everybody reports that, just right down the mayor owned the land, but you go back and you look at the records, you find out the mayor didn't own the land.
And they never built anything out there. It's still desert. Isn't it?
Yeah, they never built the tourist attraction. There was discussion of doing something with it in the year or so afterwards. I think about a year later there was something in the newspaper about that, but it never happened. But Glass is saying, well, the mayor owned the land and the mayor controlled the police department, and so he was sort of Zamora's boss, so they cooked this whole thing up together. No truth to that whatsoever. And I talked to a reporter at The Defensor Chieftain, which is the newspaper in Socorro, and he'd done an anniversary article about it. So I asked him some questions about it. And I said, you know, you're only like the second person that's ever approached any of us to talk about that. I know Zamora didn't like talking about it. I had a friend, Robert Cornett. I've done some work with him on UFOs and things. And he was down in New Mexico at the very large array, the radio astronomy facility west of Socorro. And so he called Zamora up on the phone because he was in Socorro. And Zamora says, yeah, come on down to, we're having a barbecue, come on down, but I'm not going to tell you anything about the UFO.
Hey, Kevin, we're going to come back and talk a little bit more, but let's take some phone calls, too, about these UFO cases next.